Welcome to Grid Talk, a series of conversations with the leaders and innovators shaping the 21st century grid. Hosting the podcast is Marty Rosenberg, an award-winning energy journalist. The series is sponsored by the Department of Energy's Office of Electricity Advanced Grid Research Division. Now, here's Marty Rosenberg with Grid Talk.
Hi, and welcome to Grid Talk. Today we have with us Claire Moeller, who's Mid-Continent Independent System Operator President and Chief Operating Officer. Hi, Claire. How are you today?
You know, I'm doing well.
Good. We're very pleased to have you with us today because there's a lot of meaty subjects I want to dive into. You at MISO in the middle of the country, Mid-Continent, are really at the heart of some major transformations that our energy grid is now undergoing. You just released a report that was updated in February called the MISO Response to the Reliability Imperative. That's the platform I want to jump off with you.
Okay.
It really captures a picture of an important grid serving 45 million Americans, providing their wholesale power system and reliability. What do you have to say on the top line conclusion of that report before we get into the nitty gritty?
I think the top line is things are moving in an uncoordinated fashion where we're creating risk for the grid that we maybe didn't anticipate.
Mm-hmm.
Retirements are outpacing new installations of resources on the grid. And that's a problem that we haven't had on the grid since its early formation period in the 30s.
So let's talk about that. The retirements have to do with your plans, like other parts of the country, to retire carbon-emitting resources. Talk a little bit about the carbon footprint of MISO and how you've been able to get it down.
Sure.
And how you've achieved it.
Yeah, so in 2005, about 85% of our energy came from coal. And last year, subject to check, it was more like 35%. That change has happened in a combination of the economics of gas-fired generation are much improved over what they were in the beginning. And also, in excess of 10% of our energy currently comes from renewables.
Didn't you get your carbon footprint down by over 30% since 2000 levels?
Yeah, that's about the number, yeah.
And you have a gateway or a pathway to getting it down to 80%, right?
Yeah, so the plans that our member utilities present move our footprint down to about 85% reduction by 2040, 2045.
And to understand the magnitude of that, you're the Midwest, heavily reliant on coal historically coming out of Wyoming and the Southeast. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. We have coal facilities that burnt both Western coal and Illinois Basin coal.
Mm-hmm. So your report goes into a number of problems that you're confronting, and then I'd like to talk about that in a little detail, then we'll get into the solutions that you've been implementing.
Okay.
Extreme weather. We think about what happened in Texas and its spillover effect several years ago into the Midwest. How extreme has the weather gotten, and what are your forecasts, and how are you ramping up to deal with it?
So the actual magnitude of the event is about the same as it's always been, but the frequency is increasing rather substantially. Climatologists' work indicate that what used to be a 100-year event is now like a 10-year event. So we've had four serious winter events in 6 years. And part of the reason they're serious is the changes on the generation fleet make it less reliable now than it was in the prior years.
What about summer and summer storms? Is the heat getting more hot, and is that straining the system?
We haven't seen a significant difference in summer. There was one very energetic hurricane season that caused a lot of concern, but hurricanes year to year are pretty unpredictable.
What about the need or the transformation of the grid away from large baseload carbon emitting resources to more resilient renewables. How does that create a need for long functioning, long duration batteries, hydrogen, and possibly small modular nuclear reactors? And do you see those coming on anytime soon? Maybe you want to go one by one, tick them off.
Yeah, let's go one by one, because you got about 2 days worth of questions there. The original model for the utilities, back to the beginning of utilities, was power plants around a city. And so the generation for the customers in the city, were close. And there were low reasons to tie cities together, not unlike the interstate highway system, right? So the cities were taking care of themselves. In the middle 60s, they started to connect to each other for reliability reasons, emergency reasons. But they weren't meant to move a lot of energy from one place to another. So that system was very well understood by the engineers. The traditional plants have some attributes that you take for granted that you have to engineer with a new fleet. So your battery question is an example. Prior to 2005, almost all generation looked alike. You pushed a button and electricity came out. It had storage was in fuel, so you had a 30-day supply of coal on the yard. So we had energy storage, but it looked like fuel storage. So as you move away from that traditional fuel as where you store your energy, things like batteries become important because you still need that ability to fluctuate with conditions as conditions change.
So let's just focus on batteries for a second. You have folks out at MIT investigating new technologies. How does an organization like MISO monitor what's on the horizon and plan what you may be able to rely on and when it's going to be available?
Yeah, so we tend not to rely on things until they're commercially available. So today, the commercially available battery technology is mostly the lithium ion. They're fairly short duration batteries, 4 to 6 hours. They do a wonderful job of helping you move. I call them a shapeshifter. They change the shape of the load inside a day. They're very effective at that. We see in California how they help with the ramping issues that they have as the sun goes down and the solar degrades. But so far, that's the only commercially applied battery we've seen is that fairly short duration.
Let's talk about SMRs. Our last two podcasts, in fact, focus on what's going on up in Ontario, which is not very far from you, where they're bringing on SMR technology within several years. Are you monitoring that? And what role could SMRs play in MISO in terms of reliability?
So the important thing of the small modular reactors is you have that long duration energy capability. One of our bigger risks as we move to a high renewable future is typically there's a week in the wintertime when it's overcast and the wind isn't blowing. And so I need a week's worth of energy at a time when renewables aren't producing and my batteries only have a day's worth of energy in them. So things like small modular reactors and hydrogen combustion are ways to fill that 1 week long energy deficit. And that will be very important to figure out how to do that on a cost-effective way.
Lastly, I brought up hydrogen systems. Do you see them ready for prime time anytime soon?
We haven't seen even demonstration projects yet. There's some in Europe, but nothing here. There's a lot of research being done. There's co-firing with natural gas seems to be viable in the short term, but the technology to burn only hydrogen seems to be some years away yet.
Those are the problems. And the other one that's listed in your report is supply chain and permitting issues. Why don't you tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, so, you know, we get a lot of critique about our generation interconnection queue being big and slow and ugly. But we've got over 50,000 megawatts of generation projects, mostly renewable, that have permission to connect to the grid, but aren't being constructed. Over half of those 50,000 megawatts are more than 740 days late. And when we ask why that is, what the answers we get back is supply chain, dominantly labor, as well as materials. Skilled labor is in short supply.
Well, another podcast, in fact, our most recent one, is detailing how much money the federal government has been dedicated to just this, the grid, through the Inflation Reduction Act and the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars. Do you see any of that coming into this critical juncture here of supply chain delays?
We haven't seen it work on the supply chain. We do have a Department of Energy grant to help fund some generation interconnection investments. But we don't see the supply chain, we don't see investments in the supply chain happen very quickly. When DOE asks us what we think, we suggest they should focus on skilled labor training.
Is that happening within MISO, and are you playing a role in that?
Other than being the bully pulpit, we don't have much of a role there. We do have partnerships with various universities, Purdue, Iowa State, those sorts. But the actual training of the skilled labor is outside of our purview.
So, I mean, just to put a point on it, why would a shortage of skilled labor result in over 700 days of delay in these projects that are ready to go?
Okay, so to be clear, it isn't just skilled labor, but in the skilled labor market. So I've got two sons that are in the lithium-ion battery business. And what they tell me is that the high-end technicians for inverters aren't there. And so they need to wait for that labor before they can move to construction on their project. And it's a rare skill.
So back in July of 2022, your board approved $10.3 billion of projects, 18 projects to be specific, which is the largest ever approved by a regional transmission organization. And it's the first of four tranches that you plan to roll out. Tell me what is involved in that $10.3 billion, and will it, do you suspect, hit the wall of delays that we were just discussing a minute ago?
So everything goes slower and costs more than you hoped when you approve it. Our first set of large-scale transmission projects was actually in 2011, where we approved $6 billion worth of work. That was 17 projects. 16 of those are now in service, and there's still one in litigation. So we expect that same kind of time signature on this first tranche in the long-range transmission plan. But that kind of matches the time sequence of everything else that's going on. So the plan we have to meet our members' needs for the decarbonization, the time signature of the LRTP matches pretty much what their plans are, because they have to get their generation house in order across that same time period.
So, and to give people a sense of large scale you're moving and the scope of things that you're contemplating here, that was $2.3 billion approved in July 22. A second set of portfolio projects is due to come out this year. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us the magnitude of that, and what will you layer on in addition to that $10.3 billion?
Yeah, our first estimates are 17 to 20 billion additional investments in transmission.
So, and that's the second, and there are two more coming after that?
That's correct.
The magnitude of those two, number three and number four?
I'm not even prepared to guess. By the time we're all in, there'll be over $100 billion worth of transmission investments.
What will that buy in the Midwest? What would, if you get it all and there are no delays, how would your organization look different?
Well, so its job is to enable $500 billion worth of new generation resources. Right? So the transmission, there wouldn't be any transmission were it not for the transition from fossil fuels to renewables. So transmission always follows the generation fleet. The renewable generation is widely distributed in terms of its siting, very different than one point source for a conventional power plant. So you have to build transmission to all these places to pick up the resource and then transport it to the cities where the preponderance of load is. So it's a very different system requirement than what the foundation of the utility infrastructure was.
Paint a picture for us. I'm going to ask you to be a Monet or a painter now. $500 billion of transmission is coming to the heartland of America. Is that correct?
Nope. $500 billion of new generation.
I'm sorry. That's exactly right. $500 billion. This area embraces Iowa and Kansas, two hotbeds of wind generation. Solar really has not taken off unless it has in the southern footprint of this. What's the middle of America going to be? What role do you see MISO playing with this $500 billion of generation? Will you be the muscle of America, or is this being matched all around you as well?
Well, so there'll be some rationalization of what the resource looks like over time. Today, we actually have a surprising amount of solar seeking interconnections in places that you maybe wouldn't expect it.
For example?
Minnesota, Michigan, right? The latitudes are such that in the wintertime, those resources don't produce a lot of energy. But the investment tax credits make economic sense to put them in the suboptimum places anyway. So those kinds of things over time, people will figure out that the production tax credit, the wind, keeps those located in the high wind production places.
This region, and maybe you could describe it because it goes all the way to Minnesota down to Texas, right?
Yes.
And it touches parts of Canada and Mexico as well?
Manitoba. I tell people we're the coast-to-coast RTO. We go from Hudson Bay to the Gulf of Mexico.
And 45 million wholesale customers, is that correct, approximately?
Retail, yeah.
And do you see this area, I mean, you talked a minute ago of the evolution of the grid. Cities were serving cities, and now it's becoming more regional. Do you see this region that you serve exporting, being a net exporter of energy to more distant parts of the country, or is it all going to be an island unto itself?
I think that over time, this region will become an exporter because the land use issues and the quality of the resource diminishes as you go east. There's less wind, there's more clouds, and there's more people. So that just physically siting the resources is more difficult in those urban places. And the physical size of these things is non-trivial. It takes about 5 acres of land for 1 megawatt solar farm. So if you think about the population densities in the east, taking hundreds of acres of solar collectors in addition to whatever you can get on the top of a building, it's just the land use issues will be non-trivial. And so siting the renewables where there is less population density, I think, is where long-term this is going.
So go down an economics path with me for a second. $500 billion of generation, add on transmission to connect it all. What's the impact going to be on electricity prices in your footprint?
So it's kind of hard to calculate, right? It's also true that the energy that's produced is essentially zero cost. So we're trading marginal cost energy for fixed cost investment. But energy costs at the consumer level are going to go up substantially. It's not a cheap thing to deliver free energy.
So do you think the cost of energy in this region, which is below the coast, might be closer to what it is on the coast
A
decade or two out?
I think that's true. And it'll be higher than that on the coast. Right. So the inflation will move. Everything will have to move up in order to sustain that low carbon footprint.
We've been reading a lot about the problem of large single site load additions associated with server farms and bitcoins. Is that causing wrinkles in MISO's territory?
Yeah. In addition to server farms and bitcoins, it's battery factories. It's chip foundries. These industrial loads are in excess of 1,000 megawatts in a point. And so the infrastructure to serve them obviously isn't there yet. So part of this same planning problem is to make sure you can accommodate those. The difficulty is the commercial secrecy around them. You don't know about them until somebody's inked a deal, and then everybody's in a big hurry to connect it, right? So it's hard to plan for those point loads. We've also seen some petrochemical large additions as well.
So some of the solutions that you've identified is refining generation resource planning. How is that working, and how closely do you work with utilities and generators to make sure those plans are up to snuff?
Yeah, so in our part of the country, the people who are responsible to make sure those plans are in place are actually the state regulators. So the state regulators and the utilities are on the hook for those plans, and our job is to help them see what the neighborhood is doing so that their plans are well informed by the trends across the footprint. Let me give you an example of that. A solar farm, if you only have one solar farm, does a very good job of helping you defray the risk of a summer peak day. But if you have 10,000 solar farms, what you've done is changed when the problem is to when the sun goes down. Well, you need to know that if you're a power supply planner, that the neighbors are putting in a bunch of solar farms too. So you know you can't, you're moving the risk and you can't rely on just your summer peak load addition. So it's become much more complicated for the utilities to understand the ebb and flow of that. Our main job is to help them understand how that all works together.
So there's the question of utility intelligence, but what about MISO level intelligence? As the complexity multiplies below you, how do you solve it at your level?
Well, we wrote the reliability imperative in part because we see gaps in what's happening, and we need to proceed to close those gaps. An easy example is in our system operations function. In 2005, it was pretty easy. You predicted load, you turned on generation, and if something broke, you turned on another generator. We're at the point now where we have multiple meteorologists on staff because we have to predict wind speeds, timing of wind speeds, load, cloud cover, both to how it affects load and how it affects solar output. 1 year we discovered we needed to account for smoke from Canadian wildfires because it had an impact on the solar output. So the complexity of making sure it all fits in any given day has moved from deterministic to probabilistic. So we're spending a bunch of time and skill building inside our system operations so that we can see more clearly what tomorrow looks like so we can prepare the system to meet those demands.
So let me ask you a philosophical question. MISO was one of the first ISOs, is that correct, in the 1980s?
No, actually, we were 1998 we were formed. There were power pools before that that tried to function as an RTO, but they were incomplete.
Okay.
We were the first one that was approved.
So they were created at a different reality.
Yes.
To serve a different reality. You're describing a much more complicated distributed model. Does the old system still make sense, or what you're doing, what PJM is doing, what Cal ISO is doing, does it still make sense to do it regionally, or should we have a supra ISO embracing the whole country?
There's a how big is too big to see question there. As technology improves, you can do better. But I think the layered approach to operations, not unlike air traffic control, is how you'll see it all evolving.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Let's get into one question that's kind of suggests about what we're talking about. The need to maintain transition resources as we go to a less carbon intensive system. How do you do the ballet dance of knowing how soon to retire something versus how long you need to keep it available until the new modular reactors and long-term battery storage become more ubiquitous?
Yes. So it's essentially an insurance pool. So the risk calculation of how many things are going to break and do you have enough things to fill in the gap is literally an insurance calculation. So we continue to do that insurance calculation. Challenges include we're not quite sure what the statistics look like on the newer resources, but you have a good idea of what they are on the old resources. So we used to have a whole bunch of simplifying assumptions that we could get away with because every generator kind of looked alike. We're having to revisit all of the math around how you calculate that risk, and that's what we're working very hard at. You'll see regulatory filings where we're changing how we count, whether or not we can count on this kind of generation or that kind of generation. What we're doing is refining that risk calculation so we can tell people how much they need to keep of what kind of resource so that we can keep it reliable.
Claire, the last question I want to ask you, since you've been at MISO virtually its entire existence, if you've been there 2 decades, plaster on this report that came out in February is a big, black, bold statement. We must work together and move faster. You've been there 20 years. Describe this moment now, how anxiety creating it is, how exciting it is for you to be tasked with these challenges, how significant the transformations underway will be, and how costly, as you indicated, the price tag will be. How do you see your job, and what's most exciting about it? What's most terrifying about it?
The most exciting and most terrifying are the same thing. The gap between retirements and the technology to replace those retirements, I think, is the biggest risk we face. So how to hang on to a safe transition is really important. And there's a whole bunch of nuances in that. It's hard to explain to people, but it's true that we can reduce our carbon footprint faster if we build more gas-fired generation so that we can turn off the coal plants. We don't have to let them run. And we only turn the gas plants on when we need them. But that just doesn't make sense to people that think we should turn off all combustion because that's how you reduce the carbon footprint. So those kinds of educational exchanges are, I think, what is the most important part of what MISO is about right now, to help people see what their goals are and see what the easiest, best, less expensive way to achieve those goals are. And when we talk about that, we call it least cost to achieve the decarbonization goals. And that's really important for everybody. Doing this wrong and creating reliability events will get us a backlash that would be hard to sustain. So keeping it safe People bet their lives and their livelihoods on us doing this right. So we got to do it right.
Thank you, Claire.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Claire Moeller, who's the President and Chief Operating Officer of MISO, the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator. Thanks for listening to Grid Talk, a production of the U.S. Department of Energy's Office of Electricity. We regularly convene conversations with thought leaders in the fast-changing electric sector in America and around the world. Please send us feedback or questions at gridtalk@nrel.gov. And we encourage you to give the podcast a rating or a review on your favorite podcast platform. For more information about this series, now in its fourth year, or to subscribe, please visit smartgrid.gov.
Thanks for listening to Grid Talk, presented by the U.S. Department of Energy Office of Electricity Advanced Grid Research Division. Subscribe through your favorite podcast provider or visit smartgrid.gov for more information.